Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mehler here. Time to visit with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. He's back to talk about insects. In particular, we'll zero in a bit on bees and wasps. But certainly, if you have a bug question, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Nice to be back.
When we talk about bees, most people think, honey or bumblebees, but there are many other kinds of bees in Wisconsin. Tell us about the different kinds of solitary bees that we have.
Yeah, numbers are probably close to 400 different species. The difference between a solitary bee is we have one individual female that provisions what you might want to call a nest, but there's no shared occupancy or when you think of honeybees, you think of this queen and all the workers. And generally speaking, and this works with wasps too, things that are solitary tend to be far less aggressive because there's really no true nest to defend. They, provision whatever their young eats, and they're done with it. And so they tend to be very seasonal. Many species are not even capable of stinging. Some of them look very similar to honeybees, so that kind of freaks people out. But other ones are metallic greens and blues. I mean, it's a really diverse group, and it's fun. Honeybees are not a native insect to North America. So when we think of all our native plants that evolved, most of them depended on these native bees as their main source of pollinators. And so they really are very important out there, but many times overlooked, unfortunately.
How do we attract them?
Well, as far as their nesting sites, it depends on the species. It turns out some of them will nest in the holes of wood-boring beetles in the trunks of dead trees. Other ones nest in the ground. Other ones nest in twigs. I mean, it's really diverse. And so if you're looking for that, one of the things that you can look up, and there's been a lot of interest lately, is to provide bee houses. And usually they are straw-like compartmentized things that have different diameter holes, and different bee species use different holes, and you can put those out in the backyard in the garden. And so you're basically providing the environment that they need to raise their young. And that's really the shortfall, I think, for many of them, is the habitat destruction means there's less places they can set up housekeeping. And of course, that would reduce their numbers. And then, of course, any pollen source, since it's bees, that's their main game, is to collect pollen as a protein source for their young. And then the nectar is kind of the energy source for the adults.
Let's talk about hive bees for a bit. What happens in the spring for those bees?
For honeybees?
For hive bee, any bees that have
The only hive bee we have, technically, is the honeybee. Now, where it's a little different, though, now bumblebees, what happens is they overwinter as a fertilized queen, and then they set up a colony, and they will have workers, and they do have this division of labor, that some are reproductives, but most are sterile females that work. But again, they start from a single queen, and that's, again, the system that works in our climate. What makes honeybees unusual is they have to survive the winter, which means they have to generate heat. That's one of the reasons they store honey. And by literally buzzing their wings, they generate enough heat to allow the colony to survive pretty extreme conditions, which is really a pretty interesting evolutionary trait. But all our other ones depend on either the solitary bees or the individual ones doing their thing, or the ones that live in colonies overwinter as queens, and they start everything from scratch and then build as the summer goes. And the new queens are usually developed then in the late fall, are inseminated, and then they start the whole cycle over the following year.
Yeah. Let's turn to wasps for a minute. Do they have queens as well?
Right. And that's what people see now. So the queens of the paper wasps and the yellow jackets are the ones that overwinter under bark and in rocks and other sheltered sites. And they are out searching for nesting sites now. So you're pretty sure that the ones you see right away in the spring are going to be queens. And then if they find the nesting site, they will start building. And their division of labor in many cases isn't quite as is stark as it is in honeybees, where you're either a worker or reproductive. With some of the wasp species, they can go back and forth. They're a little more flexible, but same thing. They build a nest. This nest is something that they all will defend, and so you tend to find wasps tend to be the most problematic when you disturb their nests, and that's when you're most likely to get stung.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people are afraid of wasps, actually. I mean, I've been stung by wasps more than once, and it wasn't pleasant, for sure.
But, yeah, well, you know, it's interesting in my career is, you know, things changed dramatically in the state, I thought, probably in the early 80s when the German yellow jacket became more prevalent. And the two things about that, that's a ground nesting paper wasp, and it tends to like to live in urban settings. But more important, it tends to become a real scavenger in the fall, which is attracted to garbage and food outside. And that close association really increased the number of stings. And I remember seeing the figures of the number of stings in hospitals and whatnot went up by as much as fivefold in the fall compared to before they showed up. And so there was a lot more interactions, unfortunately a lot more people with allergic reactions because of the increase. But it has been somewhat interesting to watch, even though they're still present, and we do have some native paper wasps. Their numbers have gone down considerably compared to what I remember in the 80s and early 90s, where we even had times when schools wouldn't let the kids eat outside because of the potential of all the stinging problems, especially in the fall. Not the spring, but in the fall.
Well, we have every line filled here, Phil, with people with questions. So Ellie in Hollandale, we'll go to you and see what's on your mind. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if there's anything to look for in my garden. So as I'm digging up my garden rows, I don't dig up the rusty patch bumblebee pots.
Typically, they are using pre-existing cavities, so it's usually an old gopher burrow or, you know, a rock wall that has a hole in it. So I think there are, in a lot of cases, places you do not see, it would not be in the garden, so you wouldn't have to go. If your garden is just regular soil with no pre-existing cavities, I don't think they're going to be there.
Okay, so not much to worry about.
Yeah,
there,
really not
Ellie.
Much to worry about. You know, if you see, again, you'll see the bumblebee queens now kind of looking for these cavities. And if you find a place, you can always mark it off and just leave it be. But as I said, more often than not, it's going to be kind of secretive or even under a cement slab. You know, that's not a relatively common place for bumblebees to set up housekeeping. But many times you don't really get they don't get your attention until we get in the midsummer when their numbers are high. If there's just one queen that has to go and get the pollen and stuff, there isn't near as much activity.
Ellie, thank you so much. John in Cambridge, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Morning, Larry. Gentlemen, we seem to have quite a few yellow jackets on our block in buildings, like in inside the frames of windows. They look pretty ominous, and I was wondering if there's a safe way, environmentally safe way, and a way to not get stung to get rid of them.
Well, again, is the problem now or is the problem more in the late summer?
Now, as soon as the sun comes up, they're out.
Okay, you're probably seeing some of these overwintering queens waking up, and it really is quite unusual to have multiple nests along the same side of a house. They tend to disperse. And so my first guess is they're going to go somewhere else. You know, they're just going to take off. And this tells you, though, that there probably was a nest on the structure at some time, because it isn't that unusual to see a number of queens overwintering close to where the original nest was. Now, the issue is because there's no true nest that exists, they are going to be less aggressive. Now, if you pick one up in your hands, you can potentially get stung, but I don't think they're going to really come after you. But one of the things to try to witness is where they seem to be coming from, and there's probably a crack or a small hole that they're either investigating or they're hiding under, and then it's just a physical thing that if you can plug this, you know, stuff things in it or use caulk or whatnot, you're basically eliminating the overwintering sites and also eliminating the potential nesting sites. What some of the paper wasps do, and especially that German yellow jacket I talked about, rather than nesting in the ground, sometimes they nest in wall cavities. And it's the same thing. There's a hollow void in the wall that pre-exists, and they find an opening to come and go. And so if you can plug that now in the spring, or even, again, if you got bumblebees in a place you don't want them, you know where you've got these little holes, you plug them now, you know, fill them up with dirt, and you're done. And they're really, as I said, you wouldn't expect them to be aggressive because there really is not a nest that they're defending. They're just kind of searching out these potential nesting sites for the rest of the summer.
Oh, there you go, John. Thank you. Douglas in Sun Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Douglas.
Good morning. I had a experience, I'd say 10 or 20 years ago. I was playing golf in the late summer, one of those nice, warm summer days. And we were waiting to hit our chip shots up onto the green, hopefully. And all of a sudden, it seemed like all the insects started to buzz at once. And this buzzing increased. And I wasn't close enough to my dad to talk to him, but I could see him crouch down like your fight-flight response kicked in. Is there a name for this? Has anybody else experienced this phenomenon?
Well, did you see the critters? I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is there was a honeybee swarm close by.
No, it seemed like every insect in the vicinity was, you know, buzzing their wings. That's what it seemed like.
Well, the only other thing, in the late summer, you know, you've got cicadas out there, and, you know, they get revved up, especially on a good, hot, sunny day, where the males are, and we call it calling, but they're basically signaling, trying to attack females, and, you know, that can get almost deafening, and, you know, you're going to see a lot in the press this year, because the 17-year cicada brood or group that's in Washington State, you know, D.C. is going to come out, so that's going to get a lot of press. We won't see ours here until, I think, 2024, that will come through. And that, again, if you ever experience it, is downright deafening. As I say, I always tell people it's like a science fiction movie if you've never experienced it. But that would be my guess if you didn't. I mean, if it's honeybees, you would tend to see them, and you got to get pretty close to hear all the buzzing and the like. If it was, again, just kind of this general drone, I would lean towards thinking it was cicadas, and you just picked a case where there's a whole lot of males in a small area, and they decided to talk to each other.
That's pretty cool. And I think I agree with you, Phil. It sure sounds like cicadas to me. But thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Kat and Thomas, thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to mention, like, with gardeners right now, I've been, you know, cutting some of my perennials back, and if you leave some stems on, maybe like 6 to 8 inches above the ground when you're cutting back, eventually the plant will cover that, but that's a good place for cavity nesting bees to put their nests in. And then also if you have some bare areas in your yard, or you can leave some in drier spots, that's another place where the ground nesting bees will put their nests in.
Right. Yeah. Those are both excellent ideas. I was planting something in my son-in-law's garden yesterday, and it was interesting. I saw these little mounds there, and my first inclination is, where the devil are these ants so active? But they, again, were ground nesting bees, and they were little sand piles on the surface, and it's interesting because you don't normally think of sandy soils here in Madison, but for some reason they have that kind of mucky sand there. And again, now I remember it. And then sure enough, when I went out into the bare or thinner areas of the lawn, there was a bunch of those cavities there too. But if you got into where the grass is real lush, there was no activity. And so they are looking for that kind of bare soil area to do their thing. A little less common in heavy soils has been my experience. But it's still worth experimenting with because, as I said, you're providing a potential habitat that will allow the bees to breed on your property.
Kat, thanks very much. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus, our guest today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects, zeroing in a little on wasps and bees, but we'll take other questions as well as we visit with Phil Pelletieri. You can join us at 1-800-642-1001. 1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Raleigh in Oak Creek. We'll go to you now. Hi, Raleigh.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I kind of have a part A, part B question. What endangered insects we should be looking out for, and what to do if we encounter some invasive insects, you know, such as the Asian hornet. His thoughts on that and those two things. Thanks.
All okay, right. So endangered, what it comes down to a lot of cases, if you have habitats that are in danger because of the plant species are disappearing. I mean, almost any plant you think of has probably a handful of insects associated with it. And so if the plants are gone, those insects are gone. Some of the more commonly identified insects that are endangered are often butterflies. And it's not to say that they're more important or less important than other insects, but I think people tend to be very fond of butterflies. So I very much understand that. So, the Carter blue butterfly in Wisconsin is dependent on lupin, and lupin is, growing in sandy soils in disturbed areas. And so the central part of the state is kind of a major reservoir of that butterfly, even for the whole United States. And so, the DNR does some habitat manipulations trying to promote the conditions that they have. So it's almost a case of, if you find an insect you're fond of and you have some control, you start to look at what things you can do in the environment to make life easier or available for them. Now, for exotic insects, it's interesting. Two out of three things that we would identify as a pest in Wisconsin, in fact, the whole United States, are insects that do not belong here naturally. They are usually European or Asian species that have come in. The trouble is identifying things because we have native things that look like it. So I think the best thing to do is if you think you've got something odd, take a picture of it. That's, again, a big change I saw in my career is where people could take digital images of these things. And then you could send it to the Wisconsin Department of Ag. They have a number of entomologists. Again, the DNR, it kind of depends where you see it. If you see it in the woods, that's kind of the DNR's prerogative. If you see it in your backyard, the Department of Ag, you could also send it to the local extension office. And if the agents there can identify it, they will. But if not, they can always send it to P.J. Leash, who is the gentleman who is running the diagnostic lab now. And P.J. can help sort through in whether he needs to contact you. Yes, we're more interested in this. Or, it is the Department of Ag's responsibility in most cases to investigate some of these matters. And so a lot of times if we can be kind of screeners, and then if we think it's something that's important, we can pass it on to the Department of Ag inspectors.
And speaking of inspection or identification, I wanted to mention that UW Extension has a Wisconsin Bee Identification Guide. Nice colored photos of at least a dozen of our bees that inhabit the state, the ones we're going to more likely see, with some information about them. I've got a link, or we have a link, on my page. So if you go to WPR.org/Larry and then click on today's show note, you'll find a link to that bee identification guide. I believe that it's a free guide, colored photos, and really quite nice. Raleigh, thanks again. Let's go to Ross in Middleton next. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. I have a question and then a quick comment. I was over on the Lake Mendota, the Mendota Mental Health Grounds, and they have a lot of beautiful spring ephemeral flowers. And I thought I saw three different types of those really small bees. I guess they're the solitary bees, but it was I've always kind of wondered if anything ever went to those little flowers or if they were just there. But sure enough, on this day, there was they were all kind of flying around. The question I have is regarding ants and those big ant mounds that you sometimes see if you're walking in a prairie. Do we have just one kind of ant that makes those kind of mounds, or are there different families of ants that all create those big mounds?
Yeah, we have one genus of ants. The field ants is what we typically call them. The genus is Formica, and they are notorious for making big mounds. And some live in the woods, and some live in the prairie. So it's quite common if you burn a prairie, you see these little humps, and those are old field ant or active field ant colonies. They live up to 10 to 12 years. They're relatively large ants and look very similar to carpenter ants, the ones that come in people's houses, but field ants generally don't. And it's interesting, you know, there's been lots of research in how important they are in a native setting. And in prairies, they seem to be very important both for recycling nutrients and aerating the soil. You know, if they're in the middle of your yard and sometimes these mounds get so big you can't even get the lawnmower over them, I understand the problem there. But on the other hand, as I said, if you see how they normally fit into things, they do have a very important mission. And as I said, it's not an ant that comes indoors. It is an ant, though, in some cases, that will manipulate the environment for its favor. And in particular, there's one, a famous one, although other species do this, the Allegheny mound ant, where they literally will inject formic acid into the roots of plants that are shading the top of their nest. This is the way they thermoregulate the nest, which helps them in raising their young. Now, if you're a Christmas tree grower and they're killing your baby Christmas trees, you're not real happy about that. It isn't a major problem, but it is to show you what they're capable of. And it's interesting when you look at their scientific name, the genus Formica, it refers to that formic acid that they utilize, again, for manipulating plants.
Really cool. Ross, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Donna in West Salem, we'll go to you now. Hi, Donna.
Good morning. Someone told me something, and I'm just curious. It sounds kind of crazy, but I wonder if it's true. She said that if you have a wasp problem, if you hang kind of a crumpled up paper sack, a small one, a brown one, in the area, that will kind of confuse them, and they'll think that's another wasp nest, and they'll avoid the area. And I'm wondering if that's true.
Yeah, I've heard that comment. I have never seen any scientific research to validate it. Their visual cues and what they see is very different than us. And so I'm not so sure they even identify that. And it's interesting, you know, the norm in the species that evolve in Wisconsin, they don't utilize their old nests. So, you know, I was always very comfortable in telling people the 1st of November, you could cut a nest down without a problem. They tend to weather away. But it's interesting that European paper wasp, which is one of the newer invasives, it's been in the state for probably about 10, 15 years or so, that species at times does utilize its nests, but its nests are usually hidden away that you don't see them. This seems to be the trend that things that are not native here do some funny things compared to what is the natural evolution of our insects in North America. But, I would not think so. If nests get too close, there are sometimes some wars, if you want to think of it that way, between one colony and the next, because they can identify different colony members. But I just don't think a queen, if they see a pre-existing nest, is going to pay any attention, because it, you know, biologically, it just doesn't. It isn't normally something that they would react to. It's not on their radar screen, I don't think.
There you go, Donna. Thank you, Tim in Kenosha. Your turn. Hi, Tim.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you. I just wanted to make a few comments. A great resource for native bees is the Xerces Society. They have some great books on bees in your backyard and identifying the native bees. And they do a lot of really good pollination that we don't see. Now that the dandelions are out, you can really see a lot of native bees, the different sizes and colors and shapes. Another comment on back in the day, when the colony collapse disease started happening with honeybees, a lot of people were very interested in bees and were wanting to raise bees to save the bees. I just read a comment in a bee journal not too long ago, and one of the article publishers was saying raising bees to save the bees is like raising chickens to save the birds.
You have to be a little careful, because honeybee people tend to be very sensitive and very much enjoy, and so you don't want to offend. But I mean, that's the reality, is that there is just so many native species that people just don't recognize. And as I said, when you look at historically the problems of habitat destruction and their decline in numbers, and then now in particular, you know, so it has been part of the USDA Farm Bill now to promote pollinator plots and other things that tend to enhance the environment for the native bees. Unfortunately, the way things go 10 years from now, they won't be paying people to do this, I'm afraid. But at least right now, there is that recognition of the importance of the native species and the diversity and things, even as simple as fence rows, the old-fashioned fence rows, provided a habitat for native bees, whereas, again, when we take rid of those things environmentally, they're not there. That means the bee species aren't going to have the habitat they need to be able to exist.
Thank you very much, Tim, for your comments. Appreciate it. A listener emailed to ask if chemical treatments of lake weeds kill dragonflies or damselflies or mayflies, other nymphs.
The herbicides that I'm aware of really don't have much. I mean, if you think about it, if they had toxicity that would kill fish, then I would be concerned. But the fish tend to tolerate it pretty well. Now, there are some cases that, you know, damselflies will live in the weed beds, and if you totally destroy them, I can see the loss of habitat might hurt. But as far as the chemicals themselves having toxicity issues, no, I wouldn't worry about that.
Edwin in Barron County, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I was wondering what native species we could plant in our gardens to help Wisconsin's moths and butterflies.
Oh, boy. You know, most native species will have a benefit easily recognized. Where it gets to be a little bit more ticklish is when you talk about some of the horticultural varieties that we have bred for their flowering or whatnot. In some cases, they are less attractive to the bees because of less nectar or the like. So, I mean, you could breed plants that would be more attractive to bees. Generally, that's not done. As I said, usually when people are worrying about gardening, they're worrying about the showiness of it. So going back to the other side of it, anything native, but one of the things that is good to try to provide, if you can, is things that flower throughout the season. Since those species, you know, there are different species that come out at different times, so you're providing food for them, or things even like honeybees and bumblebees that are basically active most of the year, then they have a very easily defined food source. Things in the composite family, you know, the sunflowers and whatnot, are often identified as very important plants. But again, I kind of go, if it's flowering and it's got nectar and it's got pollen, it's going to be a food resource. And as I said, the general comment would be natives are more dependable than the necessary horticulture varieties.
Mm. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. By the way, we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. And you can email us as well. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of emails, Ron in Crandon emailed. He has a small maple syrup operation in northeastern Wisconsin. He usually finds moths in the bags. Possibly these are sallow moths. This year he found almost no moths. He did find a beetle at more than half of the taps. This is a common-looking beetle, but not something he's seen regularly on the taps before. And he's wondering if these two things could be related.
It's possible. The thing that's always hard to decipher, you know, is how much impact weather patterns, whether it's winter weather or even fall weather, have on various insect populations. And so, you know, it could be easy to say, well, the moth numbers are down just because things weren't good for them this winter. The beetle, I'm a little interested, although I can think of a number of species would love to utilize a sugar source like that. But you do see that ebb and flow. You know, scientifically, you need a number of years of observations to see if you got a trend. So, you hate to say you can't make a whole lot of inferences just from 1 year's worth of data, but it is a very interesting observation. And this spring, it warmed up and now it's cooled down. I have not seen an overabundance of insects yet this spring, but as I always told people, I didn't really rely on the winter as much. I mean, if it got 40 below, you can make some correlations for insect populations that would suffer. But if it's kind of a relatively normal winter, I would tend to see the spring weather is having more of a general impact. And what seemed to be problematic is if it warms up enough that you wake up a bunch of insects and then you slam the door with some real hostile weather, that often caused maybe, I think, the most significant drops in insect populations. But, you know, it's a little early to tell with it. And by the end of May, I think we'll have a better picture of how the spring is progressing for the critters.
Kay in Sun Prairie, we'll go to you now. Hi, Kay.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
All right. Thank you for taking it. Okay, now, last summer, I have on my door frame, which is kind of in a corner with an overhang, there's the tiniest little bees, and they made mud nests, but they're in long lines. They look like icicles stuck together, but they're made out of mud, and they're tiny. I've never seen them before. What would those be?
Boy, I would have to see. There even is a chance that they are a little wasp, because there are potter wasps that build little things. In fact, generally, the mud-type tubes are more wasp-related, but I know that there are some bees that will also do that. So without something, without seeing them, technically, even though you got a number of them in an area, these are solitary critters, meaning each one has their own little tube. And again, for that reason, that makes them far less aggressive. But, yeah, without seeing a picture and whatnot and doing some digging, I don't know if I could give you the exact answer what species.
Hmm. There we go. Okay, thank you for calling. Judy in New Glarus, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I live in the village of New Glarus, and I have an anthill in my yard. And I'm just wondering if there's anything, any environmentally good way of getting rid of that.
So what the dilemma is for ants is the colony may have 10,000 individuals, but the most important member of the colony is the queen, and she's down 2 or 3 feet into the ground. And so the existence of this depends on her. If she dies for some reason, the colony's dead, and there's not a problem. Now, some people try to dig it up. If you were to dig the queen out, you're good, but you're going to have to dig pretty deep. So I find that that's not overly productive. As far as treating it, if you're inclined to use chemicals, without chemicals, I know people have tried hot water and other things, and again, not with the best results. It's worth the effort, but I almost worry more about carrying the hot water to the nest, causing a HUA problem than the ants ever could. But if you were to tend to use chemicals, the biggest mistake that people make is they treat the top of the nest. That never gets down to the queen, and honestly, you're exposing a whole bunch of things to the pesticide on the surface. If you're going to go after it, what I would suggest is get a metal rod or a broom stick or something that you can push down in the nest. And the soil is usually pretty loose because the ants have been working. It's almost like it's rotor till. So you push 2 or 3 as deep as you can channels. Then you can mix natural insecticides like pyrethrin or synthetic chemicals if you're inclined to use those. And, you know, you mix them up to whatever the label directions are. These are general lawn and garden insecticides. And you pour it on deep into the ground. So you're basically soaking into those channels you provide. Then you can cap it off with untreated soil. So, again, you are very much being selective in where you're putting the product and not exposing other things. And you find that strategy will work. And as I said, if you're more comfortable with some of the organic insecticides, I think those would be suitable choices. It's all about how you use it. And again, to me, it's getting it down to where the queen is likely located. And if you kill her, then the colony's dead.
All right. There you go, Judy. Thank you. Pookie in Stevens Point. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I wanted to know what kind of bee this was, because I had a 5-gallon bucket of 3/4 full of dirt. And I was going to use it to pot plants, but bees started going in there. And I know that bees are solitary, but this was a nest. And they were there all summer long and never bothered me, just always went in and out.
Did they look like bumblebees at all? Because, I mean, that would be my first guess.
They didn't. They actually look like honeybees, but a little smaller.
Yeah, again, where I'm confused is that, you know, we just don't have colony bees. Those are the true nest-making bees versus, you know, did you have 6 or 8 solitary bees utilizing the same area? And, you know, there are a couple examples where you have a single hole on the surface and there are 4 or 5 different females utilizing it. And if you were to dissect into the ground, what you find is each have their own individual chamber where they're doing their thing. And so it could be in one of those groups that there are andrenids and the like. But as I said, my first take is when I see something that lasts for a very long time versus most of the solitary bees are often, you know, have a 3 or 4 week window when they're active as adults. When they go for all summer long, then I'm more inclined to believe that it's something like a bumblebee, which is, you know, starts with the queen, builds the colony throughout the year, and then everything dies off. If you ever get a chance to get a picture of one, and I know, you know, sometimes it's not so easy to do, but again, sending one off to PJ or whatnot would be worth it. I may be able to give you something a little more specific with that.
I had some wasps once that inhabited a half a bag of soil, and I unfortunately wasn't aware of it and opened up the bag and got about 5 stings.
Yeah, I got caught one time. I was pruning bushes in the front of the house. And a bumblebee came out and gave me just a little bit of a sting, and I thought that was a little odd, being that aggressive. And I got in and started pruning again, and all of a sudden another one came out after me. And they had decided to set up housekeeping in an old bird nest. Again, that's a cavity. I've seen them also in little bird houses, wooden houses with a little hole. That's a cavity. And so you will get things like bumblebees taking advantage of that and setting up a nest.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, and a number of callers online. There's one open line at 800-642-1234, but let's go to Ken in Madison next. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. I've got property with a creek right in the corner, and there's walnut trees all along it, and it's a huge backyard, and I'll be putting in some freestanding solar panels that'll actually be each panel, large panel will be supported by I-beams, so vertically. So I'm wondering what would be something good to plant under that. And I like honeybees as well as butterflies.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part of it. I was distracted looking at a picture of a bee that was just sent me. So.
Okay, I live, I've got a huge backyard, and in the corner is a creek, and all along that creek are walnut trees.
Okay.
And with putting in these freestanding high sun plants, I'm wondering what I could plant under it as kind of a no-mo that would also benefit either honeybees or butterflies.
Yeah, well, you know, clovers are good, but what I'm a little concerned about is, you know, walnut trees don't get along with a whole lot of things. They give off chemicals that are somewhat or downright toxic to many plants. And so you often see that the understory isn't very good. But as I said, clovers are something that you know, are present most of the summer. I mean, that's why honeybee people like clovers being present, and they're various different kinds, and you know, a lot of times if the stands are set up right, sometimes it's worth mowing them maybe once, more to get rid of the weed competition than anything else. But I think that would be the direction I would go in, and butterflies will utilize that too, of course.
No, there you go. Thank you so much. And you were talking about being distracted by a photo, and I was as looking at it as well. A listener emailed a photo and wondering what kind of bee is
right.
Present.
So a couple things. The photo is of what we sometimes refer to as bee hotels. These are these little tube-like structures. This looks like it might be bamboo, which is providing the kind of environment that some bees and some wasps will utilize. You know, it could be a leafcutter bee, but, you know, here's where it gets complicated in that of the 400 species, if you're really trying to identify what the species is, you have to go as far as looking at the shapes of the veins on the wings and looking at the face to see the various lines in the face and whatnot. So I said other than looking like it could be one of the early season leafcutter or mason bees, but that's a bit of a guess. I would not be 100% certain that that is what we got. But it does look like a structure that the mason bees would utilize, which are really one of the more readily available. You can even buy mason bee houses with bees already in them, although I usually tell people you're better if you know what they need. You build one of these houses and let our native mason bees take care of it rather than paying all the money to get somebody to ship some to you.
Yeah, and you know, Bill emailed about that. He said that he has several mason bee houses, but no bees. He was thinking of buying some, but he's read that you shouldn't do that because they may have disease or mites and so forth. They're just spreading those problems. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a concern. We have this same concern with, you know, butterflies being raised commercially and shipped. And at least with the butterflies, they have to have a USDA permit. I am not so sure that all the bees that get shipped here are certified by either a state or USDA inspector. So, you know, there's always the potential that you spread the diseases from other places. On the other hand, if you don't have any in the area, it may be worth a shot in that at least you can try to get them established and see if that goes. Because, you know, if you've got a pocket of 6 miles with no mason bees around, you can set up all the houses you want, and you're not going to have any success, unfortunately. So, as I said, I don't think it's an absolute break-the-deal kind of consideration, but it is always a consideration when you're importing things from other places. It might be worth asking the sources to see if they have any kind of inspection, because in many cases, Department of Agriculture's in the state will have to certify if you're shipping things out of state. So as I said, if they've got that kind of certification, then I think you'd be pretty comfortable that if you're bringing in mason bees, that they're not going to be giving you any problems.
Let's take a call from Nita in Hustisford. Hi, Nita.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
To get back to bumblebees, I was just wondering how important are they as pollinators, because I know there's not that many around as opposed to other bees. And also, is there a way to encourage them to hang out more in your yard? And also, I had heard that they overwinter, like that they hibernate under leaves and stuff. Is that true? I thought somebody earlier had said that they die out over the winter.
The only thing that spends the winter are the fertilized queens. So the workers die out, but the fertilized queens are how they get through the winter. And they will crawl in some protected place. So, you know, it could be leaf litter, but typically I think they're looking more for under the bark of trees or, you know, crawl into a space in a rock wall where you're a little bit more sheltered. As far as promoting them, you know, again, providing just good food sources. And they are specialized. There are certain plants that depend on bumblebees as their major pollinator. In fact, for tomatoes, bumblebees are far more important than honeybees just because the way the flower is structured, in the way the bumblebee goes after the nectar, they are much better pollinators. And so it is important to have them around. You know, we have about a dozen species of native bumblebees. Some of them are very hard to find. In fact, a couple have become extinct. But then we have some European bumblebees that have moved in, so we have some non-native ones. And any bumblebee is good, although in the scheme of nature, there's always a twist. There are some bumblebee species that invade the nests of other bumblebees and take over and kill them. And they all look very similar, you know, unless you're used to looking at bumblebees. And so some of their worst enemies are their first cousins that you would identify as a bumblebee. But most of the time, you know, bumblebees tend to be pretty, and definitely they're not aggressive when you're in the garden. And the only time you have trouble is when you get close to the nest. And different species have different personalities. Some of the prairie ones tend to be a little bit more aggressive Some of the more woodland types tend to be a little bit less. But if you do have a nest in an area, you know, whether you have to rope it off or whatnot, just so people don't get too close, you'll be fine. I've driven over a nest with a lawnmower and they didn't take offense at it, although I would not recommend that.
There you go, Nita. Thank you for calling. Wade in Colby, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. Just wondering if Phil had any experience with the Silphium borer moth that's endangered in Wisconsin, but it inhabits a lot of the very popular compass plant and rosin weed and compass plant. Wondering if you've messed around with that bug.
I have not, but I know people. Les Fergie is a gentleman. He's the best moth person I know, or one of the best. There's two, I guess, would come to mind. And Les has worked with that, you know, knowing it's a problem because you don't find it all the places you'd expect it. But once you find it in an area, as long as you don't manipulate the environment in the wrong direction, it stays. You can find populations on an annual basis. Yeah, as I said, we do have populations. You know, one of the arguments is they may be a little bit more widespread than some people think just because there's not a lot of people looking for them. But on the other side, as you say, you get into places where you've got the right plants and no moths, and the question comes up, why is that? I mean, that suggests that there's something else missing in what they need.
Yeah. Wade, thank you.
You know, and what's interesting is we have a related species, the common stalk borer, that gets into everything. In fact, once in a while it shows up and kills somebody's tomato, and so you define it as a pest. And so that's kind of a generalist. What makes this one so much more having potential problems is there's far fewer plants it can utilize.
Wade, again, thank you. Colette in Eagle River. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I live up in Eagle River, and last fall we tilled up a bank of soil facing the road in the south so we could plant some daffodils. And this spring, I look in there, and it's covered with hundreds of little bees that are just, because it's in the sun, it's warm. It's not today because it's freezing, but when it's warm, and they just go in about a half an inch, and they seem very harmless, and they just cover the whole surface of this little, you know, 3-by-30-foot strip. I was trying to figure out what they are.
Well, again, this is one of those spring solitary bees, and you provided a habitat. And my guess is if there was a lot of vegetation there before you cleared it, it wasn't. But now the ones in the area have found that this is a great place to set up housekeeping. And, again, you know, put some daffodils, that will be fine. My guess is if you mulch it heavily, they will not show up again. But if you leave it the bare soil, they will continue. And again, I think you're going to see this is very seasonal. The ones that are active this early in the spring are active for a couple, 3 weeks, and then they're gone, and you won't see them again until next spring. And again, without seeing the species, but a good number of the spring ones are not even capable of stinging, even though they're technically bees.
Interesting. Thank you, Colette, for calling. Mark in Beaver Dam. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. The question I have is about mason bees. Is it time now to put mason bees out?
Yes. You know, we're getting close. You know, if we had another week of this real cold stuff, I'd say, boy, if you could hold them out. But I think with things warming up, you know, you usually think, I mean, mason bees are often identified as important pollinators for things like apples, which are a pretty early season bloomer. And you know, one of the arguments is they're active at temperatures that are cooler than some of our native or some of our other native bees would be. So, yeah, I don't think there's really any problem, at least from what I can foresee in the weather patterns the next couple of weeks. I think, in fact, your timing is perfect.
All right. There you go, Mark. And let's see, Carol in Washburn. Hi.
Yes. Good morning. Yes. My concern is the bee houses. First, I'd like to say I had some crocuses outside where we had those warm few days and bees and butterflies. It has to be very warm weather. I saw numerous little, I don't know the difference between a mason orchard bee, but I was fascinated by it. And then tiny little ones. So I think we need to plant more crocuses because that was the only source of pollen I had in my garden. But my reason for calling, I had bought a few different bee houses, and I bought one from Wild Birds Unlimited, and it had very tiny holes, and I did put varathane over it some years ago just to preserve it. Then I bought another bee house that had different size. That was fine for me, but then I ordered from Gardener Supply, and I have never seen such huge, huge holes. What do they do, put four or five family members in? I can't imagine what type of bee would be in such gigantic holes. I'm somewhat puzzled on that.
Different size holes would be utilized by different species, and if you start to get to be relatively big, you know, something a half inch or more, that sounds like it's too big for anything I would normally expect to take over there. And so, you know, it might be somebody that's kind of stretching the truth here a little bit on what works and what doesn't.
Oh, there you go, Carol. Thanks for calling. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, he's going to be with us right up until 12:30. We will take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Phil. I'm Larry Mueller. So happy to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and distinguished faculty emeritus. He headed the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, retired in 2014, and still comes by on occasion to talk with us about insects. I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And Phil, we had Benny emailed a photo that I wanted to mention of a plant he kept over winter in his heated garage. This is a nest of yellow garden spiders that hatched out. He's keeping them in a cold frame so they don't die in the freezing temperatures outside. He'll let them go once the threat is gone.
Yeah, cool. You know, so the tough dilemma here, I'm a little concerned that the young will start feeding on each other because there's no other food. But, you know, I think you can walk a line here. You know, of course, you don't want to expose them to you know, 10 degrees and extremes. But if you hold them at between 40 to 50, I think metabolically they will be relatively inactive, but you won't hurt them. And then when it finally does warm up enough that you can let them out and disperse, things will be fine. So, yeah,
that's
so it's very, very kind of him. And it's also neat that he could recognize what he had there. So, and people see this a lot. You know, when you bring plants indoors, all kinds of interesting things come out of the ground or the plants at times. And in fact, that was one of the more common things I'd see in the diagnostic lab is in the winter when you see these strange summer type insects. That's usually what the question is what kind of plant material did you bring indoors to overwinter?
Yeah. Unfortunately, scale comes along too once in a while.
In fungus gnats. And yeah, there's some unfriendly things, unfortunately.
Linda in Fox Crossing. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question regarding bees under my front porch. They've been there for years. Unfortunately, anytime you want to go in and out the front door, there's several of them just, you know, milling around and just moving around. I first tried 2 years ago to get somebody to remove them because I didn't want to destroy them, but I couldn't find anybody. Is there anyone in Wisconsin that does that is my first question, and if not, what do I do to actually get rid of them?
Okay, so what is going on under the porch? I mean, is it bare soil? I mean, what kind of environment are we talking about?
There are holes because the ground has sunk, and so the there's a space between the concrete and the ground in a couple places. And any time we cover it up, well, they just, you know, come back, make the hole again. So I didn't want to kill them, so I didn't.
Yeah, well, again, I mean, this is the time of year to do something. The only bee that anybody is going to come and get rid of is, and not get rid of, but kind of recycle our honeybees. You know, there sometimes you can find a local honeybee person who is willing to come and take a colony. But any other species, I don't know of anybody that would deal with it. And again, I can't think of anything other than trying to plug the holes now before things get started. You know, you might have to play around with your soil types. You might even want to go with something that's a little more clay-like that they're going to have a harder time to get through, you know, until you can convince them to go elsewhere. But I think what it is you're just providing a beautiful place for them to set up housekeeping. And until you prevent that, and as I said, since so many of these are starting with queens looking for a place to set up a nest now, this is the time to shut the door. Once you get into the summer, what I'm concerned about is there enough critters already in there. They'll dig their way out. That's not a problem. But right now, they don't have the numbers to do anything like that.
Okay, there you go.
You might even consider just burying a little bit of landscape fabric
And
then put the soil over it, because that'll give you an added barrier that they probably can't get through.
That's a good idea. Linda, thank you. Mark in Kimberly, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. The current issue of National Geographic has an article on insects in the rainforest canopy in the Amazon, and photos are exquisite, two-page photos of this iridescent blue and green bumblebee, and the intricacy of all the parts, it shows up in these photos. It's fabulous, and it's we've got to end this ongoing tragedy, this emergency of mass extinction of all these insects down there in the Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely, when you look at numbers and diversity, the more you get into the rainforests, the numbers go up by over tenfold in numbers of species. And so you can see when you destroy the habitat, you're taking so many species out. And, you know, unfortunately, that's what the prediction is that this will continue to go because of habitat destruction. And again, you look at localized examples here of things we say that have disappeared because of the land use changes, but you can pretty well figure that in the tropics, it is just so much more staggering because there's so much more diversity.
Yeah. Mark, thank you. Greg in Waukesha, your turn now. Hi, Greg.
Hi. We have a Leonard Messel magnolia in our backyard, and for about the last 10 years, it's a beautiful tree, and it's enlarged itself. But for about the last 6 years, it's had scale really bad. And I've tried an assortment of organic solutions, waxes, organic sprays, physical removal, et cetera, and nothing's worked. So 3 years ago, we made the decision to do a systemic. And the systemic is a neonicotinoid derivative. But I'm very afraid to use that. I don't want to harm wasps or bees, and I raise honeybees. So I'm trying to figure out if there is an alternative or if my timing has been that I did it so that it would not coincide with flowering. But it doesn't really seem to get rid of the problem.
Yeah. Two thoughts on that. I think your choice of not doing it when it's flowering was probably the best decision you can make for saving the honeybees. But the problem with systemics in woody trees is the way it moves through the plant. Although I would expect it to help reduce the population, I never see it being 100% successful because it doesn't get in all the places it needs to in sufficient concentration. Now, the other avenue is the weakness of a scale insect is when the eggs hatch and they're little tiny scales and developing. And that timing differs depending on the species and what makes magnolia scale really quite different, because more often than not, the timing is in the spring or early summer. But the proper treatment time for magnolia scale is in September, because that's when they're hatching. Even a soapy water spray would give you some relief. The difference between the chemicals you use, though, is that some of the other chemicals have longer residuals, which gives you better traction, you know, better chance. But to me, again, timing is even more important than what you select. If you want to use insecticidal soap, as I said, you would want to have very good coverage of the tree, and I would use a window somewhere around the, you know, first to second week of September when to treat. You can try pyrethrin. I'm trying to think of another organic spray. You know, one of the tricks here is that organic does not mean non-toxic to bees. I mean, everything has a bit of an issue. I mean, what makes pyrethrin appealing is it degrades in sunlight. And so if there's no bees on the tree, there shouldn't be a problem. Although, you know, I'll throw one other caveat there. You know, when those scales bloom in July and you get all the sap flowing and whatnot, it wouldn't surprise me that the bees are utilizing that as a sugar source. But by September, that should be done. So that should be less of an issue. So it said somehow mark a calendar and get after it. And I want enough pressure that, you know, you're shaking up the foliage pretty good. You, as I said, you need some pretty good coverage here. And if it's a big tree, that might become somewhat problematic.
Greg, good luck. Thank you. Cinnamon in Sturgeon Bay, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm a vegetable gardener. I have a beautiful backyard vegetable garden. And I've planted native pollinator plants all the way around it. And I thought that the beneficial insects would keep some of the nasty guys off of my vegetables, but I'm still having a problem with things like squash vine borers and cucumber beetles. And I'm wondering if there's something that you would recommend that's going to be safe for all those beneficial insects on the pollinator plants, but that would help take care of some of the nasty guys.
Oh boy, I mean, it's walking a little bit of a fine line. I mean, the first thing is, again, you identify who's your real stinker, who's really giving you a problem. And with squash vine borer, everything is going downhill from the last week of June and the first 2 weeks of July. There are some organic sprays, in particular, spinosad. I know the product under Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew is one of the products. And in particular, when you're spraying that, you know, the critter is problematic when it lays its eggs towards the base of the plant. I don't care if it lays its eggs up by the leaves in the farther out portions, because that's not going to hurt it. What kills the plant is the caterpillar burrowing in the center of the plant. And so if you were to just treat that base of the plant in that 1 or 2 week period of time, once, if things are really problematic, maybe a second application 10 to 14 days after that, I don't think that's going to have the least amount of impact I see on other beneficials. It is a somewhat selective pesticide. It tends to be a little bit better on caterpillars, some beetles, but it isn't quite as broad spectrum as some of the other things. So that's one of the pluses that you've got. And again, I can't think of some of the beneficials like some of the parasitic wasps and ground beetles and some of the other critters you'd like to have around that really shouldn't be much impacted by that. Now, if there's another critter, you kind of have to do the same thing. You know, when's that critical time? What kind of adjustments can I make as far as selection of product or how I apply it to have the least amount of impact? But it's hard in a garden, you know, because if you give one general rule, it's really not going to solve all the problems. As I said, I think you almost have to address each problem individually and then kind of work it up from there.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Cinnamon. Esther in Grays Lake, Illinois, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yes, I have an above-ground swimming pool in my backyard, and in, I would say, midsummer, the late summer, it is quite an attraction for yellow jackets. It creates a lot of anxiety for myself and my grandsons that like to swim, you know, going up and down the ladder. I mean, they're just everywhere. Any recommendations for keeping them away?
You know, normally water shouldn't be quite that much of an interest. I get this call that honeybees come to visit somebody's bird bath or their pool or whatnot because somebody's got bees close by, and honeybees take the water back and use it to cool the nest, and so they have more of a water need. When I hear yellow jackets, the first thing that comes to mind to me is there garbage cans? Is there a source of food that gets them in the habit? Because they're almost like ants, that if they find a food source, they will keep coming back. So, you know, if the kids spill some pop and we don't clean it up sufficiently, be darned, they find out about it, and all of a sudden that increases it. So I would try to identify what's drawing them in, and I would think it's more food-related than it is necessarily the water. Because, as I said, it's just... not normal. The only other thing I can think of are the little stinkers setting up a nest underneath something or close by, and that's why you're seeing so much activity. Sometimes for that, it's just worth to kind of sit there and patiently watch what they're doing. Now, if they take off and fly into the sunset, that's not going to help. But what I'm looking for is if there's a pattern that a whole bunch of them start going into an area or whatnot, that would suggest you've got a nest, and then you can deal with it directly. And, of course, if you solve the nest problem, you're taking them out by the hundreds at a time, versus if you set up yellow jacket traps and whatnot, you're catching a few workers, but you're really not having the kind of impact that you want.
Oh. Esther, thank you. Mary in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. All this talk about bees reminded me of when I was growing up in Illinois. We had an elevated front porch, and underneath there would be bees hanging around, and us kids would kind of freak out, and my dad would say, well, you don't have to worry about these. They won't sting you. And to show us, he would catch one in his hand, and he said, you can tell, he called them wood bees, and he said, you can tell a wood bee because it has a white dot on its head. And he would hold it in his hand, and he would shake it up, and you could hear it buzzing, but it never stung because it couldn't sting. And I'm wondering, does Wisconsin have wood bees?
Well, what I think he's calling a wood bee, I would be inclined to call a carpenter bee. And carpenter bees, in some cases, it depends on the species, look very similar to bumblebees, but they have more of a shiny abdomen to them. But there are other smaller species that might fit. And as he suggests, I mean, they nest in rotting wood, but they are a solitary bee. So first of all, they're non-aggressive. But the other thing I'm wondering, if he was a little bit of a lucky person and he was picking up males, and males are not capable of stinging, because as far as I know, female carpenter bees are capable of stinging. And again, they're not very aggressive because it's not this colony like a yellow jacket or a bumblebee colony where we got a queen and young to defend. But you can have a number of these. We get a lot of problems in soffits and overhangs as the wood starts to go bad of carpenter bees getting in. And one of the interesting things, I mean, normally it was more of a southern insect, but towards the end of my career, all of a sudden we started seeing carpenter bees become more frequent in the southern third of Wisconsin. And this is that, you know, phenomena of insects moving northward as the winters have become less severe. So I'm guessing that they are carpenter bees, but as I said, I'm just wondering if he was lucky. As a kid, we used to go out and collect honeybees on the clover and cup them in our hands and think they wouldn't sting. Well, you do that enough times and you do get stung, unfortunately. So.
Mary, thank you. And you know what? Mary's from Green Bay, and that reminded me that UW Green Bay has been designated a Bee City USA, so officially recognized as an ally in the fight to conserve native pollinators. It was kind of our Central Time program on Tuesday, I believe. Yeah, I'm sure it was Tuesday, covered this and has a little interview with relating to it. And Laura Pavin of our staff had written a little story on it. But UW Green Bay designated a Bee City USA. I think it's kind of like the Tree City program that's out there. Phil?
Yeah. And also, I think, some of the bird societies will grant cities things by doing some adjustments. And usually what it is, again, is kind of respecting what you got there and doing things to enhance habitat, to increase the diversity of species that we've got.
Yeah. Peter in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a lawn care company that wants to sell me a grub control application. I'm wondering what these grubs are. Are they bad for the lawn? And is killing them off bad for the world?
Okay. So before Japanese beetle got here, June beetle grubs potentially could be a lawn pest. Japanese beetles moved here, and they potentially could be a lawn pest. But, again, back in the olden days when Phil started, when you would buy any kind of fertilizer, they all had insecticide to kill grubs. And what really was disconcerting about that is the potential of having enough grubs in your lawn to cause damage to the lawn is less than 1 in 100 as far as I'm concerned. So the only reason you justify putting insecticide on is if the grubs are numerous enough that the grass is dying. And the way you confirm that is to pull back the dead areas and see a bunch of grubs. If there's no grubs there in a dead area, I'm more inclined to believe it's disease. And again, we don't have the kind of grub problems that justify putting preventative insecticides on it. So they said, I'm not a fan of that in this climate. And one of the problems, too, is even if the grubs do cause damage enough to catch your attention, often it's getting kind of late to even solve the problem. And definitely we don't have reoccurring problems saying, well, if they kill my lawn now, they're going to kill it next year. Well, probably not in most cases. And so, as I said, you need more of a justification, I think, to put insecticide on lawn to kill grubs than just because it's nice and easy. And as I said, if it's less than 1 in 100 chance of having it, in fact, I think it's probably 1 in 500. You just don't see that many. And, you know, we had a very bad Japanese beetle problems here in the early 2000s. And even with that, I never had enough grubs in my lawn to kill it. My problem was the golf course that is two blocks away, and there they could be as numerous as 150 per square foot. But they manage golf courses in a way that's much better for the grubs. And I don't water my lawn when it gets really dry. Grubs don't like that. And so, as I said, even though there's a lot of Japanese beetles in my neighborhood, I would not have gained anything by killing the Japanese beetle grubs in my lawn because that's not where my problem was coming from.
Very interesting. Thank you, Peter. John in Mount Horeb. Hi.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about the landscaping around our house. On the advice of some earlier guests, you know, last fall and winter, we did not cut down some of our taller landscaping plants, things like coneflower and black-eyed Susan and sedum, and there's some grasses as well. And the advice was that a lot of insects overwinter in those stems or in the litter. And so we still have not cut them down, but we're getting anxious to do so. So the question is, when should they be cut down? Do you have any general guidance on that question?
Yeah, you know, to me it's a little more plant dependent. When I think of sedum, I don't know a whole lot of critters that would be in sedum to overwinter that I want around. To be honest, they're more likely to be stem pests or root pests. So I think you're fine now. The point is that things that spend the winter as adults, you know, have got the protection that you provided them for the getting through the winter, but they're dispersing now. They're going doing their thing, and so I don't see any problem at all cutting it anytime. You know, when things finally warm up to wake up the first insects, it's time for them to move on. You know, we generally do a pretty thorough garden cleanup in the fall just because, I can't think of anything that I'm enhancing. Now, if we go back to the compass plant, you know, when we had a question earlier in the show about a particular borer that's in compass plant, then I could make the argument, yeah, leave it. You know, that critter, needs those to be able to survive. But there isn't that many insects I can think of in normal landscape plants that I'm that concerned about.
Phil, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I always enjoy.
Phil Pelletieri. He'll be back, and we'll have him on the show again for sure. Well, thanks so much for listening. We'll talk about summer travel tomorrow and also take a look at Wisconsin's Ed program. So I hope you'll tune in for that. But stay with us through the afternoon. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.